I can only say that when I come here, I feel as if I've died and gone to heaven. And so thank you so much. And thank you, Rabbi. This is my, one of my favorite synagogues in the world. And those of you who are lucky enough to be members of it will certainly appreciate why that should be so. In any case, this feels like a real homecoming to me, and thank you for having me here. Also want to say that since I want to speak about my book today, I think it's redundant for some of you from what you've been kind enough to say. Many people here seem to have been acquainted with it already, but maybe this can drive some points home. So as Rick rightly said, I was prompted to write this book because of a problem that's been gnawing at me most of my life. Personally, I happen to love being a Jew. I love Jewish literature and culture. I appreciate Jewish observance, and I am proud of Jewish achievement. But from childhood on, I've been troubled by the Jewish political record. The distinguished historian Louis Namier was once asked but why he, a Jew, devoted himself to writing English history rather than Jewish history. "There is no Jewish history," Namier replied. "There is only Jewish martyrology, and that is not amusing enough for me." Now, Namier's Oxford colleague, Isaiah Berlin, was a little put out by the tone of Namier's comment, but he agreed with the substance, and he added, "The annals of the Jews between the destruction of the Second Temple and comparatively recent times is indeed largely a story of persecution and martyrdom, an unbroken struggle against greater odds than any other human community has ever had to contend with." So I ask why this continues to be the condition of the Jews. If Jews have created such an otherwise admirable civilization, why have they proved so unsuccessful at politics? What bothers me in particular is that Zionism was meant to regularize the place of the Jews in the world. Tremendous efforts went into that undertaking. Why then does the political condition of the Jews remain so exceptional? To explain something does not mean that you can solve a problem. If I explain the causes of starvation, it doesn't necessarily mean that I can supply the nourishment to alleviate it, but no problem can be solved unless we first identify it correctly and define it. And that's what I try to do in my book. So I'll divide my comments into three parts. And the first part I would call the great political experiment. Now, the Roman defeat of the Jews in the year 70 of the Common Era was, I believe, the defining political event in the life of the Jewish people. Following a three-year siege, Titus crushed the Jewish uprising, burnt the temple, and leveled the city so that, according to Josephus, no one visiting the spot would believe that it had once been inhabited. 65 years later, Rome put down a second Jewish rebellion with a brutality that deterred all further insurrection. Though some Jews always continued to live in the land of Israel, the vast majority over the next 18 centuries, as you all know, tried to follow the Jewish way of life outside its borders. Now, mourning the great destruction, the Churban, became so intense that it almost competed with praise of God as the central motif of Jewish worship. "Rebuild Jerusalem, the holy city, quickly in our time," reads the liturgy that is incorporated into the grace after meals. When a Jew dies, family members are consoled with the words, "May God comfort you among the mourners of Zion and Jerusalem." We take solace in our personal bereavement by acknowledging the national grief that joins us to all other Jews who have suffered the loss of Jerusalem. For 3 weeks of every year, culminating in the fast of the ninth day of the Hebrew month of Av, Jews commemorate the fall of Jerusalem. And the annual Passover Seder, of course, concludes with the pledge next year in Jerusalem, and so on. You can all think of many more customs and passages that can be added to this list. The Jews' mourning for the loss of their land guaranteed their eventual return to it, but in the meantime, they learned to live outside it. I think it's important to see or to think about what features of Jewish life made it possible for Jews to live abroad as a nation. And among the most important of these, I think, is the following. Already many centuries earlier, in 586 before the Common Era, the Babylonians destroyed Solomon's temple that had served as the center of Jewish religious worship and drove Jewish leadership into exile. At that point, Jews might have evaporated in history, like so many another conquered people. That they didn't assimilate is largely due to how they perceived, how they understood their relationship to God. Through the covenant at Sinai, Jews had entered into a contractual agreement with an Almighty whose moral law demanded certain forms of behavior and forbade other forms of behavior. In return for obeying God's law, Jews had been promised that they would someday multiply and prosper in their land of Israel. King of Kings was not merely a metaphor. It was the precise description of how the Almighty dominated the political triangle that Jews thought they formed with foreign nations. Jews would be protected from aggressors if they satisfied the terms of their covenant with the Almighty. Now, thanks to this description, thanks to this understanding of their position, the prophets, the Hebrew prophets, felt justified in interpreting the defeat of the Jews as the consequence of God's dissatisfaction with his people. The prophets taught that the political fate of the Jews depended on their ability to convince not their rivals of their military prowess, but God of their uprightness. Jeremiah says in the name of the Lord, "For my people have done a twofold wrong. They have forsaken me, the fount of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns, which cannot even hold water." So Jeremiah tells the Jews that they were defeated because they abandoned God's commandments and because they became idolaters. And he promises again in the name of God that they will regain divine protection once they mend their ways. So the Hebrew prophets linked a nation's potency to its moral strength, putting the Jews on perpetual trial for their political actions before a supreme judge. By thus maintaining an independent reckoning, Jews did not have to accept their conquest by another people. They didn't have to accept conquest by their enemies as any judgment on their staying powers. Now, other nations accept defeat as the arbiter of their fate. And of course, it's obvious that Jews also recognize the difference between conquering and being conquered. But by situating their politics within that transcendent scheme of judgment, they did not have to accept the verdict of the battlefield as final. The explanation of military defeat as the consequence not of the enemy's prowess, but of the Jews' failure to please the Lord, insulated the Jews from some of the vagaries of war. A temporary rout left open the possibility for an eventual reversal, just as temporary displacement from the land of Israel allowed for eventual return to it. The more power Jews ascribed to God, the more politically independent they became of the power that other nations wielded over them. At the same time, living under the aegis of a God who kept an extended rather than a short-term reckoning instilled a very high level of accountability, since the behavior of this entire people, their everyday habits, would determine the severity of collective punishment or the possibility of collective reward. And I think that this sense of political autonomy is the main reason that Jews could survive any number of conquests and still remain, in their own minds, undefeated. There are, of course, many other factors that contributed to the creative survival of the Jewish people in exile, including a constitutional culture, a self-disciplining way of life based on the teachings of the Hebrew Bible, emphasis on individual responsibility for men and women, communal infrastructure for education and social services, requirement of universal literacy, and so forth. Here, I just want to summarize them all to say that the Jewish diaspora proved to be one of the world's great political experiments. A nation undertook to live without three staples of nationhood: without land, without a central political authority, and without any means of independent self-defense. I don't mean to say that Jews one day said to themselves, "Eureka, let's launch a new political experiment." It didn't work that way. They just went out into the world and did it. But nevertheless, one can see that an experiment is certainly what it was. And as a result of this experiment, Jewish communities flourished wherever they were permitted to do so. Jews negotiated their relationship with those in power, trying to work out the most favorable conditions for permanent residence. Now, the diaspora required perpetual creative accommodation to local political rule and to socioeconomic opportunities. And it proved astonishingly successful, since, as I say, Jews flourished wherever they were permitted to do so. Look up the synonyms for adaptation, and you will discover Jewish communities at work: elastic, flexible, pliable, supple. Jews tried to master skills that would make them indispensable. Under some conditions, this meant money lending, tax farming, minting, or banking. Elsewhere, it meant craftsmanship. They became shoemakers, tailors, carpenters, glaziers, all the trades that are turned into metaphor in the Yom Kippur prayer, Ki hine kachomer biyad hayotzer, that likens material in the hands of the craftsman to the soul of the Jew before God. And Salo Baron, the historian, describes how the Jews tried to compensate for their political weakness with economic strength, even turning dispersion itself into an asset by developing international trade routes. Now, taking note of the Jewish community's exceptional powers of adjustment, the 19th century economic sociologist and historian Werner Sombart deduced that the Jews must be nomads, or as he called them, Saharans, perpetual wanderers who mastered trade and commerce in the process of migration. It was an ingenious theory, but it was a theory that drew the wrong conclusions from accurate observations. The Jews were exceptionally adaptable, but they were nothing like nomads in their habits, in their social organization, or in their cultural inclinations. Nomadic peoples move cyclically or periodically, following the food supply of an agricultural economy, or else fulfilling the functions of tradesmen. The social and political and cultural institution of nomads are geared to the habits of frequent relocation. By contrast, Jews manifested the opposite penchant for sinking roots and establishing enduring institutions wherever they were permitted to. And this pattern of adjustment made Jews very reliable and loyal subjects, since they owed their protection to the rulers, and they would not willingly risk the displeasure of the powers that be. So all this is so far part one, the great political experiment, and I would say that so far I could have done this in much greater detail, and historians can, of course, do it in phenomenal detail. One can describe the success, or perhaps one could say even the triumph, of the Jewish political experiment. But built into the Jewish political condition was the inability to protect whatever they attained or achieved. Jewish leaders negotiated with those in power to ensure the protection of the Jews. But at some point or other, a change of authority, a threat to the kingdom from a foreign attacker, the uprising of a restive underclass, or some other destabilizing political event would force or persuade the ruler, who had until then given the Jews protection, to withdraw that protection, or else to join the assault against them. Extrapolating from many such historical situations, the historian Gerson Cohen noted, and I quote, "The safety of the Jews will always depend upon a society in which their interests are guaranteed and maintained, but that any breakdown of the social discipline within such a society exposes Jews to resentment and danger." And he pays special attention to popular uprisings, popular eruptions against the Jews that rulers and clergy are powerless to check, drawing examples from the Jewish community of Elephantine in Upper Egypt, which was destroyed in 411 before the Common Era, the Jews of Alexandria in 37 of the Common Era, the Crusades of 1096, the Spanish riots of 1391, and the Ukrainian pogroms of 1648-49, to show how in each case the Jews were sacrificed by their former protectors to the violence of the mob. Jews had visible power and goods to tempt their attackers, but they had no means, no independent means, of defending that power and those goods once the political shield was withdrawn. So one could say, as a rule of thumb, it was always profitable to take over Jewish power and property, and there was never any political cost to be paid for doing so. Jews became a no-fail target. They may have thought they were indestructible because the remnant of Jews always picked themselves up and started over. But looking at that same phenomenon, other nations considered the Jews very easy prey. So Cohen's analysis stops in the year 1648. But in fact, the situation entered a new phase at the very point that one was entitled to believe that political progress was underway. Enlightenment and emancipation introduced the idea and the practice of democracy that was supposed to guarantee equal rights and opportunities to every citizen. Many Jews were certain that their troubles were now at an end. With their habitual talents for adjustment, they entered the professions, they expanded commerce, and of course, yes, they served in the military alongside other citizen draftees. But this wonderful moment, and it was a truly wonderful moment in human history, had unexpected consequences. Once upon a time, the Jews had to convince only the king of the good they could bring to a kingdom in order to win his protection. Now, even kings had to satisfy their constituencies. Leaders now had to persuade societies of their right to rule, and governments had to explain their actions to the people. So nations undergoing emancipation, industrialization, urbanization, secularization, experienced tremendous anxiety. Anti-Semitism was introduced formally in the 1870s in response to the destabilizing features of emancipation and modernity and democracy. Wilhelm Marr was among the first to recognize the uncommon power of what today we would call negative campaigning. His popular pamphlet of 1879, The Victory of Jewry Over Germandom, draws attention to Jewish successes and blames those successes for the crises of Germany. Marr recognized that democracy in practice meant free and open competition. And so he charged that emancipation had allowed the Jews to use their cunning to conquer the new country from within. He warned that thanks to emancipation, Jews had already become the leading superpower. He wrote, "In Germany, it is not Jewry that has merged into Germandom, but Germandom that has merged into Jewry." And we notice that the attack against the Jews is cast defensively, not offensively, but defensively. It's defensive warfare against a political outcome that he does not like. So Marr introduced this politics of blame, and he called it anti-Semitism to distinguish it from earlier Christian Judeophobia. And he offered a fairly simple cause for what was going wrong. And one can say it in these kind of terms. Are you unemployed? Yes, you know why. It's because the Jews have taken your jobs. Are you poor and needy? Well, of course, the Rothschilds have your money. Are you more troubled than you were before? Yes, it's because the Jews are undermining our values. Is the church losing its authority? Well, yes, of course, the Jews are taking control of our culture. Politicians and thinkers of both the left and the right represented Jews as the corrupting agents of capitalism and communism. Because Jews so visibly benefited from emancipation and from democracy, it was easy to blame them for its problems. Jews were visible enough to be convincing in this demonized role. And here one might say that, you know, we often compare, we say, yes, well, the gypsies were also the targets of a similar kind of hatred. This is certainly true. The gypsies were attacked, certainly in Hitler's period, as fiercely. But you could not blame the gypsies for the problems of Germany. The gypsies were not a convincing target ideologically in the same way. So in that sense, that the ideology of anti-Semitism, the political idea that anti-Semitism represents, really could only work in relation to the Jews. And of course, once the Zionist movement formed, the attempt of Jewish leaders to counteract anti-Semitism was used by anti-Semites as proof of a Jewish world conspiracy. And to this very dangerous mix, Hitler added the element of racial purity, arguing for the need for Aryan supremacy. He conducted a war against the Jews under the cover of his conquest of Europe. The destruction of European Jewry was, of course, a massacre so total that there was no term to describe it. In 1942, the jurist Raphael Lemkin coined the word genocide to signify the destruction of a national, ethnic, or religious group, and the Jews were all three. To describe this massacre, Yiddish used the term churban, the same term it uses for the destruction of the two temples, indicating that the Jews now stood between two political catastrophes, the loss of their sovereignty at the hands of the Romans and the destruction almost 19 centuries later of the greatest diaspora community of them all. Now, of course, many Jews had perceived the threat of anti-Semitism. Millions had come to America. Others, like Theodor Herzl, realized that in a time of emerging nation states, the Jews must also reclaim their homeland. Zionists concluded, very reasonably, it seems to me, that the Jewish diaspora was, after all, the root of the political problem. Normalize the Jewish homeland and you would eliminate the cause of anti-Semitism, because Jews would then have their own land, they would interfere with no one else, and they would therefore be out of harm's way. This was a logical inference, and it did ultimately allow for Jewish self-defense. So here we come to the third part. The reestablishment of a Jewish state in the same decade as the Holocaust seems to me to be one of the greatest miracles in the history of the world. The settlers who reclaimed the land of Israel tried to make it a home for the entire Jewish people, including the most damaged refugees of the Second World War and those who were fleeing many other countries of oppression. The Jews of Palestine developed the infrastructure of a central government, a system of education and a university, orchestras, theaters, commerce, industry. Jews proved astonishingly adept at almost every aspect of running a country as if they had been preparing for it for 2,000 years. But what they could not foresee, and I think what they could not have imagined, and I don't think what anyone imagined, I cannot find a thinker who could have foreseen this, that the instrumentality of anti-Semitism could work just as well against a Jewish country as it did against the Jews in dispersion. If we remember that anti-Semitism was useful to anti-liberal elements in Europe, it was that much more useful to Arab potentates in the Middle East, especially once the Holocaust had shown how very easy it was to destroy the Jews, something that the Mufti of Jerusalem, leader of the Palestinian Arabs, had urged Hitler to complete. The Jews of Israel remained a tiny polity in the midst of other nations. They retained the political habits of diaspora communities, wanting to be productive, wanting to be the helpful middleman, as Shimon Peres, the present president of Israel, and many others said, wanting it to be like the Switzerland of the Middle East, supplying what others needed, living among non-Jews on the best possible terms they could achieve. The Zionists insisted that they did not come with the sword. In fact, the Jewish communities in Palestine, the Jewish community in Palestine was notoriously slow in organizing even primitive forms of self-defense. But as Wilhelm Marr had said at the outset, the Jews did not come to us with the sword. They did not have to. Emancipation allowed them to use their cunning to conquer the new region from within. So like Marr, but much more so, Arab leaders were concerned about the advent of pluralism, which meant competition, democracy and liberalism, which meant an end to their autocratic rule, modernity, which meant change on every front. They did not care about the size of Israel. They needed an organizing target for their opposition. They were afraid of precisely the help that the Zionists wanted to offer them. The autocrats, the dictators, the tyrants, and the up-and-coming politicians of the Arab world wanted to control their societies, and they found in anti-Zionism, which had once been anti-Semitism, the perfect tool for doing this. Because of its usefulness as a political tool, anti-Semitism was the only ideology that made an effortless transition from Christian and post-Christian Europe to the Middle East. The Arab League, formed in 1945 with a specific goal of preventing the emergence of Israel, and common enmity to Israel has been the main feature of Arab politics ever since. Some refer to the Arab-Israel or Arab-Palestinian War as a territorial conflict, the struggle of two people over one land. How many times have you heard that? The struggle of two peoples over one land. Unfortunately, it is anything but that. 22 Arab countries occupy one-tenth of the world's land surface, and I believe something like 640 times more land than Israel. The Arab objection to Israel has never been a war over territory. It has been a war against the idea of a Jewish state, against the legitimacy of a Jewish state, and against the historical rights of the Jewish people. More than that, much more than that, it is the excuse for a new version of the politics of blame. And one hardly knows, really, given the nature of the Arab world as we see it still in such turmoil, one really doesn't know what can replace anti-Semitism as a political force of that magnitude in their societies at the present moment. So many observers object to the conflation of anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, protesting that the Arab world is nothing like Europe and that the two situations are nothing alike. Well, this is perfectly true, but the effect of these differences has been to make anti-Zionism much more virulent than anti-Semitism because the societies using it are starting from so much farther behind. After all, in Europe, there was already a liberal tradition that was there within European countries that was not anti-Semitic and that tried to prevent anti-Semitism from rising. But there is no such massive liberal movement within Arab societies as yet. And one could go on to so many ways in which anti-Zionism in the Arab world is more dangerous. Just to give you one, anti-Zionism enjoys over anti-Semitism, I would say, the technological advantages of a Mac over an Underwood typewriter. Whereas Hitler, if you remember, had to function as his own impresario in organizing mass rallies, parades, in order to create these spontaneous demonstrations, Arab rulers can use methods of mass communication, right? You just have to put on the protocols of the Elders of Zion as a television show, and it is seen by millions in their own homes. This is an ease of spreading this kind of propaganda that former anti-Semites never enjoyed. So one can give many such examples, and all this to say that that this ideology of organizing blame against the Jews really passed from one society to another in Europe, and then from Europe to the Middle East, where it is quite common among all Arab societies, alas. So at this point, I think you may be asking, so why have you told us all this? So did you come here to depress us? Are you saying the Jews can never get out of their predicament? What's the answer to this problem? Well, I remind you that when I began, I said that to explain a problem does not necessarily mean to say that one can solve it. But personally, I happen to get depressed only when I can't figure things out. And I find a great deal of comfort in seeing things as they are. But more than clarity, I really do think that we can find some hopefulness in the situation that I've been describing. And that hopefulness comes from the fact that much of what I have said about the Jews happens to bear some relation to democracy in the United States as well. In his review of my book for Commentary magazine, the Wall Street Journal editorial writer Brett Stevens says that alert readers of my book will be struck by the relevance of its concerns to the dilemma confronted by the United States today in our struggle with radical Islam. Now, this is no accident. In the book, I try to show that the strengths of the Jews are precisely the ones that are developed in constitutional democracies. The Jewish culture was in effect a constitutional culture, and that it very closely resembles the constitutional, the thick, the substantive constitutional culture of the democracy in which we live. These strengths we know, but maybe we should appreciate them more deeply. the individual rights that we enjoy, the expectations of equal treatment before the law, universal suffrage, plus the benefits of an economy that thrives when people are free to cooperate, to compete, and, as in the case of the writers, to organize for better pay. But with the advantages of democracy come liabilities. And these liabilities, unfortunately, we Jews are in a position to appreciate as no other people can. In 1983, the French political thinker Jean-François Revel wrote a book called How Democracies Perish. And he sets out there precisely the problems of both Israel and the United States. He writes, "Democracy is by its very nature turned inward. Its vocation is the patient and realistic improvement of life in a community." He writes, "Democracies tend to ignore, even deny, threats to its existence because it loathes doing what is needed to counter them. It awakens only when the danger becomes deadly, imminent, evident. By then, either there is too little time for it to save itself, or the price of survival has become crushingly high." He writes, "Democracies are beset by guilt-producing accusations and intimidation that no other political system has had to tolerate," and so on. Every one of his observations is an observation which applies in a very precise way to the situation of the Jews that I've been describing. These warnings apply equally to Jewish politics and, at the present moment, to American politics, as he claims they do to all democracies. So that Revel's concern for the survival of democracy dovetails exactly with our concerns for Israel. The strengths and the weaknesses of individuals and nations are often linked, and we have to learn to augment the strengths without falling prey to the weaknesses. Is it difficult? Obviously. But is it impossible? No, I don't think it is. I think that the ability to protect oneself more effectively and to learn to face the dangers that really do confront one is something that courageous people can really undertake to do and can learn to do. I think that, and I hope that we Jews are becoming smarter about it, and that we will be smarter about it in the future than we have been in the past. I did not think that I would make a plug for anything in particular, but since Rabbi Wolpe did mention the AIPAC conference, I would say that there has not been, I think, in Jewish life, an organization like AIPAC before, which works so effectively at, in fact, organizing a counterforce against the forces that have risen against Israel and against America as well. And I think that it's that kind of move, that kind of understanding of the role in history that should allow us to be more hopeful in the present than we have been in the past. Thanks.
You can actually bring that over so that they'll...